time. Make you feel like you under a spell or two.
From WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton, I'm Stephanie Coachman, and this is your WSLR News headlines for Wednesday, May 27th. Florida budget negotiations are drawing scrutiny in Tallahassee. According to the Florida Trident, Peregrine Technologies, a California-based data integration company that employs the husband of Sarasota State Representative Fiona McFarland, could receive a $6 million state contract under the proposed House budget plan. The funding would support the company's maritime and waterway-related technology initiatives. McFarland, who represents parts of Sarasota and Manatee counties, has not been accused of wrongdoing, and the report notes there is no evidence she directly influenced the appropriation. Still, ethics watchdogs say the proposal is likely to raise questions about transparency and conflicts of interest as lawmakers finalize the state budget before the new fiscal year begins. Meanwhile, Sarasota County Schools continues to face pressure from staffing cuts tied to declining enrollment and ongoing budget challenges. WUSF reports that so far 85 teachers and instructional staff members have not been reassigned for the upcoming school year following district-wide non-renewals. The cuts have especially impacted middle school programs, including the orchestra program at Pine View School in Osprey, where parents and students have been speaking out after the district chose not to renew the school's dedicated orchestra teacher. District leaders say enrollment declines, rising operational costs, and expanded school voucher usage are all contributing to tighter budgets across the county. Officials say they are continuing efforts to place affected employees into other openings before the new school year begins. Across Florida, more families are also reporting financial strain at the grocery store. A new statewide survey commissioned by No Kid Hungry Florida found a growing number of households are struggling to afford food, with many parents saying rising prices are forcing difficult choices between groceries, housing, transportation, and health care. Advocates say the pressure is hitting working families especially hard, even as employment numbers remain relatively stable statewide. The findings come as food banks and community organizations across the Sun Coast continue reporting increased demand for assistance heading into the summer months, a time when many children lose access to school meal programs. Until next time, stay informed, stay grounded, and stay engaged. I'm Stephanie Coachman, and this has been your WSLR News headlines.
Good morning. Welcome to the Peace and Justice Report. Right here on your own community radio station, WSLR, LP 96.5 FM Sarasota, WBPV, LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton, streaming live at WSLR.org and on the WSLR app. And I definitely want to let you know that the opinions you hear today are strictly those of the host and the guest and do not necessarily reflect those of the management team, the board of directors, or any of the volunteers affiliated with the station. And we do have a special guest in the studio today, and her name is Cynthia Fabian. Is that like the musician Fabian? If you pronounce it the same way?
It is.
Let's get this mic up a little bit here.
It is.
And I'll put the mic on. So let's see. Okay. Let's see if you're being heard now, Cynthia. Go ahead.
Hey, how are you?
Oh, good. I think it's coming through fine. Fine. Cynthia, I want to let the audience know I met you a couple of months ago at the book fair down in Venice. And so why don't you tell the audience a little bit about yourself, how you happen to be at that book fair. I know you've written several books, but just let's focus on you for a few minutes so we can get some a background story.
Okay, and I have a pretty interesting background story. I met Bob at the fair, and I was there with Sisters in Crime. I am not a crime writer, but they accept all kinds of writers, and they have a booth, and I wanted to showcase my books, which focus on children overcoming obstacles in their life, and don't we all? And I feel like that's a backstory for me. I've been writing for almost 40 years, and from becoming a teacher, I really was able to understand the children and everything that they were going through. It's not just growing pains, but they have obstacles that people can't diagnose sometimes. So I write books for them.
Well, I was taking a look at your website this morning, and it's pretty impressive, the number of books you've written, but even more so than that, that the subjects that you've covered. So why don't you begin, with the very first book? I know you were a school teacher, and
yes.
Give us some info on your experience as a school teacher, how long you did teach school, and how that played a key role in your becoming an author.
Before I was a teacher, I did write the book Can't Enable, and that is because it was a catharsis, and I myself felt like the character called Kant, and he was just about a star that couldn't shine. He didn't have a proper shine gauge, and so I felt like that, and I even wrote it in the book that I grew writing Can't Enable, which continues to help people all over in skilled nursing facilities, et cetera, because it's an inspirational story.
Why don't you elaborate a little bit about that story when people say Can't Enable? Why don't you, what does that actually entail?
I had a wonderful artist, and it's about a star who can't shine properly. He just, it's kind of like a Rudolph story in a way. And he gets with the other stars, or he goes to hang out with them, and they tease him, of course, because he's different. And it's a story of identity. And he is, I don't want to be a spoiler.
No.
But he actually saves another star. And I won't tell you what happens in the end. You're going to have to buy the book. But he finds his place. And this book has been around for a very long time, and it's still a very good seller, and people, young and old, love it. It's called Can't Enable.
Can't Enable. That is so. When I looked at that today, and I was thinking it's just so appropriate because, that's probably the most used word that comes out of people's mouths is, I can't do that. I've never done that before in my life. I can't do it now. And so it's so apropos for people in general, and it's to have a story around a star that cannot shine.
Yeah.
And that's more than creative, as far as I'm concerned, that you would come up with that idea. So Can't Enable. So I know that. Tell us a little bit about yourself and how you were able to overcome that negative self-talk and do things that you never thought you'd
well,
be able to
I,
do.
Sorry. I myself have epilepsy. So at the time when I wrote Can't Enable, I was sort of trying to bring myself out. And I didn't start teaching until I was about 40 years old because I had to get over a lot of things and find the proper medication. But I did write books, and that one and Orchestra in Our Brain, which is about a child with epilepsy, were for me, really. They were about finding myself and bringing myself to the world. And I started writing after that. And again, Orchestra in Our Brain is out there, and people still buy it. And it's bought every year at the Epilepsy Conference in Josh Provides. And I feel like it's a very wonderful book, and it still resonates with a lot of people with epilepsy and their families. And I have other books as well if you would like me to talk about them.
Oh, of course. Right. Why don't we focus on that one just a little bit more, only because you have epilepsy. You're still dealing with epilepsy.
I feel like I'm a very lucky person that I'm completely seizure free, and I have been for many, many years. I still have to be very careful, but I try to go on to the websites and I still connect. I'm still in a focus group or a group for persons with epilepsy, and I just listen and I do try to help sometimes. They don't really need my help, but I do try to go into the group and help out. And I think having that book helps me to stay connected and reminds me I do have epilepsy because it's been a very long time. And I still can help other people that actively seizure now. And it's not my life, but I always want to help others in some way.
Right, right. I'm sure that was a major motivation in writing the books that you have written. Yes, go ahead and talk about a couple of the other books.
Okay. So I just recently wrote, I wrote two middle grade fiction books, and they're by, the first one you could pretty much find anywhere. It's Figure Eight, Book One, about a boy with dyscalculia, a math disorder. And I had a lot of ESOL children in high school that had this disorder coupled with dyslexia, which everybody does know what dyslexia is, the language disorder or the English. But the math disorder, dyscalculia, is more rare, and it's only diagnosed in about 7% of the children and adults. It's very hard to diagnose, and if you're not a native language speaker, some of them both, they have both. It's very difficult to diagnose. And so these children don't understand why they can't read a menu. They get confused about small things. The children are all on computers now, so there's so many things that help. But they don't understand why they can't do basic math or why numbers just don't make sense to them. And the book, by the time it gets to a Figure Eight, Book Two, adds a few more characters and finds its way to have all the kids helping one another. And there is one character with dyslexia, and they sort of help each other to do their assignments and things of that nature. But it was a very challenging book to write, and it was based on a genius friend that I knew in New Jersey. And people do come up to me and say, why isn't there a book on blank? And I felt like I had to write her story, and it was her story, but I made the character a man, a male, Max, because they felt that a boy won't read a character about a girl, but a girl will read a character about a boy. So I had to change it and change everything about the character, and I made the character Max. The character was not supposed to be a boy, but it worked out in the end.
That's interesting. The girl will read a book about a boy, but a boy will not read a book about a girl.
With the main protagonist.
With the main protagonist, yes, mm-hmm. Yes.
So we have a lot to learn.
Well, we do. So how many years did you actually teach school then?
I didn't actually teach for too long. It was less than 20 years.
That sounds like a long time to me.
I happen to still volunteer to teach, and I teach very young children now, and I read to them because I feel that's the most important thing that you can do for a young child. And I show up once a month, and I read a story, and I try to bring an exercise. And it's challenging for me because I was a high school teacher, and right. These little tiny things running around, and they really want to learn. And so it's always my pleasure to come in and read to them.
So tell us about another book.
Well, the second book, To Figure Eight, Book One, was Figure Eight, Book Two. And that one, in the process of writing it, I was sort of stuck a little, even though I never get any kind of, you know, I never get stuck. I was, because I didn't know how to develop the characters. They seemed flat to me. And so I went and I was talking to a friend who had alopecia areata. It's you're not sick in any way, but your body has almost an autoimmune system problem where you don't generate hair follicles. So you may be bald in different degrees. So she was saying to me, why don't you have a book about alopecia? There aren't any out there. I would really love to have them. And I made a character in the book about a young lady with alopecia and how she copes at like 12 or 13 years old with alopecia totalis, which is completely no hair, and all the wigs that she wears and the fun that she has, and the finding her identity, which is the most important thing that you can have in your life, is your identity and your self-confidence. So that's how that happened. That was Figure Eight, Book Two. And that one is on Spotify, on my website. Book One is, and Book Two is available everywhere, but Book One is on my website, and you look for Figure Eight, Book One, and the Spotify version is there. You could click on. I also have...
Let's give the audience your website.
Okay.
CynthiaFabianBooks.com. So it's CynthiaFabianBooks.com.
Thank you. I appreciate it. So, yeah, there's also a free book giveaway with Max... as a young child, young Max, and that's on, you know, you'll be able to find that on my website. You click on and you'll see that it's free today. And that would be great if you all go to it and get your free digital copy. So
this is the book number two.
That's number two, but this
is Max McDonald.
Max McDonald.
A kid with?
Dyscalculia.
Dyscalculia.
And that's,
I never heard of dyscalculia, like most people probably haven't.
Most people have not heard of it, and it's because it was based on a genius friend that I knew, and she overcame dyscalculia, even though her life was very hard. She wanted to remain anonymous. And but she did teach me a lot about it. And I usually get these inspirations from people, and I feel as if it's so important to give people something that they need and want in life, in a book or some other way. So that
let me let the listening audience know that we're talking with Cynthia Fabian.
Yeah.
And the children's author, book author, and the subject matter is really impressive to me, because as you said, you're writing books around particular problems, and they're not problems, they're genetic, something you were born with.
Yeah.
And you know, giving the parent, anyone who it comes in contact with children with these particular genetic problems, the confidence and the self-esteem to live a good life, and not and either live with them or work with them so that they go into the background. So go ahead and give us a good feel as to how your books have been received, and you can certainly mention a few others along the way.
I do feel that everybody deserves to live their best life. And in having as many protagonists that either a general disorder like Cant and Abel that everybody could resonate with, or other books where I try to get characters that have disorders, but they're still having fun, and they're still living their life, and they're quirky, and they might struggle, but they still feel like, hey, I can do this. And especially if there's a couple of friends around them that root them on. It's not easy for adults, and you have to particularly understand that kids don't have the experience that we have. And sometimes we forget that and expect them to cope with things. But sometimes if they see something in a funny way, like Max, the original Max book and this one, he feels like his life is so tough that it's like a walk through a peanut butter jar.
He feels like it's a
walk. He feels that's how the first book opens up.
Right.
And I don't know if you have that one, but I've written about 10 books, so I couldn't bring all of them with me today. but I can tell you that was exactly how Max felt in the book.
That's good. How did you come up with that one? A walk through
a peanut butter jar.
That is good.
Yeah, so that's how he resonated with me, and that's how the book started. And eventually he does work through things. He never becomes perfect, and that's the aim of all my books, to show that, hey, we're never going to maybe get rid of this. This may be with us for life, but we learn to deal with it the best we know how and live our precious, wonderful life, maybe help others that have this disorder, and they can go on as well.
If you didn't have epilepsy and had that experience and had been a school teacher, I mean, you probably never would have written these books.
Yeah, and the funny thing was, is I felt I never lived a sheltered life at all. And I said, well, it's very far. But the only job they have available for me when I lived in New York City was teaching in the Bronx. And I said, you know, I never led a sheltered life. I bet I could help these kids. And I got to the Bronx, and I realized that I did lead a sheltered life. And these poor kids really did need me. And I was able to help them because I could understand a lot of what they were going through, and not epilepsy per se, but I was able to feel the different disorders that they had, and they would deal with a lot of death, and mostly they would be eating junk food for breakfast, so it didn't give them the ability to think. So it was a very tough job, but I learned to really love the kids, and I appreciated them, and many of them were able to go on and get very good jobs and excel. And I'm very happy about that.
Let me read about one of your other books. Join Cantfield the Can on his adventure outside his refrigerator home as he explores the world of possibilities when he and his fellow aluminum cans, pieces of paper and plastic and other landfill beings are recycled, repurposed, and reused. So he actually has written a book on recycling through Cantfield the Can and everything in the refrigerator that needed to be recycled. How did that come into your mind?
Well, I wasn't actually the greatest turtle walker in the world, but I was walking the beach. I always was an environmentalist, but I was walking the beach and I noticed how much garbage that people, it would just, maybe it would blow, maybe people would drop it, bottles, papers, cans, and that all goes in our precious waterways. And I thought about, you know, one day I found a can, and we were obligated to pick it up and put it in the bag, which we did when we were watching for the turtles. And I said, well, you know, there should be children. I see children not really caring. Sometimes they're throwing things, and maybe the parents might not see that and correct it. But I thought about writing Can Feel the Can, and it's actually what does it, if you can feel for the can, if you could look at the can and say, hey, you know, this can could have another life. It, look at it. Let's not just throw it. Look at what happens to the can. He gets kicked around when someone throws him, and this couple of bully kids were kicking him, and what happens to him. Since I wrote Can Feel the Can, I actually save all my little tops. I don't like to drink anything from a can, but when I do enjoy a seltzer, I have very little, thankfully. I put the tab inside a plastic bag, okay, which I'm going to reuse, and I plan to send them to the Ronald McDonald House because they do collect the tabs from sodas. So I've started asking other people that do drink soda and things of that nature, can you save me the tab? So I have quite a bit. But I don't think on my own I will ever save up enough tabs to help the Ronald McDonald House. So I did donate books there. I donated Canton Able and a few of the other ones. But we're still getting there, and every time I read Canton Able to children, not Canton Able, Can Feel the Can, you see, too many.
Can Feel the Can.
Can Feel the Can. I show them the examples of things that were made out of garbage. Not really garbage, but I'll wear like a recycled shirt, recycled clothes, and I'll say, see, this was made out of bottles. And I'll try to be the poster person for reusing. And they just look and they're so fascinated. And it really helps a great deal that this book about a can could bring so much awareness. So that was really why I wrote it, to bring awareness.
Well, it's interesting because I've had a little question in my mind the last many weeks because I had friends visiting from New Hampshire this winter. They were here for a month. They had a place. And every time I see her, she's collecting these the little tabs. Now, you take it off the can. And she said the little town where she lives in New Hampshire, the fire station, got enough money from these little tabs that they were able to buy a new ambulance or a fire engine or something substantial. I said, I just couldn't believe it. So ever since she's left, we have a cat and we open the can and I've been saving these. And I say, do I have to send them to New Hampshire? There must be people in Sarasota and Bradenton and Venice doing the same thing. You know, it's just amazing that they could earn that much money from the little tabs on the can.
There are a lot of people that drink soda, and aluminum, I think, is worth about $80 a pound. So when you think about it, if a lot of people are donating the aluminum tabs,
right,
that could really benefit a charity.
Oh yeah, if it can buy a fire engine or an ambulance, whatever it bought, as I said, it was a very expensive item. It might have been something less expensive than that, but I was shocked when she told me. So I have all these tabs. I got to take. They're not that easy to take off.
They're not. You have to wiggle them a little bit.
Yeah. So we have about five more minutes, Cynthia. So if you want to go into anything else here during the next couple of minutes. And there's another book here that I'm looking at on your website, Erica's Tripod. You didn't mention that.
Oh, my gosh.
You didn't mention that one yet. A book about a girl with muscular dystrophy.
Yeah, so that was an earlier book as well. And I had a student that had muscular dystrophy. And I loosely based the character on her. All my characters are just kind of, I get the idea of the condition, and then I'm able to bring it to life. And her mother used to tell me how she used to cope, and sometimes she felt left out. And it all boils down to the same thing about loving yourself all the time and having a good identity and feeling that, you know what, you're okay no matter what. And you just love yourself and love your ability to help others and be at your best. So that was a really difficult book for me to write. I had a gifted artist at the time that was able to bring the character to life. And we even had a little one of those stair lifts that he designed for her to go up the stairs. And she had a dog named Tripod, and mother kept bringing home pets. And Tripod was this dog that had three legs. And she'd watch the dog and wonder why the dog wasn't bothered by the fact that it had three legs. And they don't. They don't care. They just get up and they move on. Unlike us humans who make things very complicated, dogs or cats, or they'll get up, or other animals, and they'll just walk. They compensate. So she was, in the book, she was upset with the dog. She said, wait, you know, why are you doing this? Are you making fun of me that I can't just go on? And she eventually does learn to have some resolve. It wasn't that easy in her case, but she learns all the fun things that life has to offer, and the love, because the dog became very dedicated to her. And dogs are wonderful. I really love dogs. We have a parrot, but I love dogs as well.
You have a talking parrot?
We have a talking parrot. Luckily, not a minor bird. Because she would probably hear some things.
Right. So let's see. It's anything else? A secondhand art. That's another book.
Secondhand art. That was I met an artist in a health food store when I lived in Queens, New York. And excuse me, the artist told me about his recycled art. And it wasn't popular really for people to do it then, but he would create art out of found items. And I based the book on him. And the funny thing wasn't funny, but I wrote the book before Superstorm Sandy hit the Northeast. And it became very popular because it was about a community surviving a hurricane. And I had the artist finding things after the hurricane and creating art. And his art was there. His art was in the book. And his son did the tone-on-tone overlay. And it was very, really beautifully written. Many artists still come by and buy that book when I'm at a fair. I always take lots of copies. It remains popular because of the art and the subject matter. And every time we have a hurricane, there's a surge in sales.
That's interesting.
And I think that everybody who has a pop top that they're not using, you should save them and you should send them to Bob.
Yeah, right. I know there has to be some nonprofits in the
That's
area
right.
that could take advantage of it. So
look.
I hope word gets out there and somebody contacts me or contacts you around this. And let's give your website one more time. And if you'd like people to, I would think some people who have had some of the children or themselves had some of these genetic problems that they've had to work around, grow up with, live with, would have an interest in talking with you, definitely taking a look at your book. So Go ahead, CynthiaFabianBooks.com.
Yes.
And you want to sign off with anything else, Cynthia?
No, I'll go to the website. You'll find Max McDonald. And I'd love to hear from you.
You're giving that away for free
today. I am. Yeah. I am. Just click on the link on my website, and it'll take you over to where it will be free. And my other book is on Spotify, Figure Eight Book One. You can get that. And it was a pleasure being here today, Bob.
Well, it's been a pleasure having you. It was great meeting you down at the Venice Book Fair. And let me see. I'm going to put some music on here so we could we'll say goodbye off the air.
Good, because you don't want me to sing.
The Constitution says freedom of religion. Well, that's what some people think. No, really, it's freedom from religion. From religion. To take you where you want to go. Call it who and what you please. Rain down your love on everyone. Bring me to my knees. Freedom of religion, to give you something great to live for, something to believe in, something more than what you're seeing. Call it what you want, go where you want to go, shout it from the rooftops, let everybody know. From religion. Now there's a different side. The freedom to believe in nothing, that it's a non-existent ride. Going nowhere, nothing in there, no real mystery going on. Make no excuses for it, and still be left alone. From the freedom of religion, that would require you to be everything that they believe in, instead of being free. From the freedom of religion, to tell your kids the dinosaurs really lived 5,000 years ago, 'cause that's when the Bible says it was. Freedom of religion, to embrace the love divine. Turn your attention deep inside and let your love light shine. Is the freedom of religion, that's the original guarantee. You can believe in a different secret and you can still be free.
That was Rod McDonald from his CD, Songs of Freedom. And I have a special guest on the line. You're listening to Peace and Justice Report right here on WSLR, LP 96.5 FM Sarasota, WBPV, LP 100.1 FM Bradenton, streaming live at WSLR.org and on the WSLR app. And I have a special guest right now on the line. I just want to tell you a little bit about him. Actually, his name is Jeremy Kusmaroff from COVID Action Magazine. And Jeremy teaches at universities, and I had some information here in front of me. Jeremy, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, Jeremy, I'm going to put the volume up a bit for you. And I know you teach several different courses at different universities over the years. Tell us about some of the courses, but I want to talk about COVID Action Magazine and the article that I came across last night. So just tell us a little bit about yourself before we go into that piece that you had just written yesterday.
Okay, sure. I teach generally on courses on U.S. foreign relations and U.S. politics. The COVID Action Magazine, the editor, the magazine was founded in the 70s by CIA whistleblower Philip Agee, and it aims to promote critical thinking on U.S. foreign policy and expose covert operations.
Well, it's a coincidence that I found that piece by you last night, because I had a guest on the show last week who was grew up, spent his beginning years in Cuba, and he moved to the States, had a very, very successful career in the States, and in the late 90s, he had formed a humanitarian organization that would help Cuba and send supplies to Cuba. And so we talked about what's currently transpiring in Cuba. And, you know, from the interview I had with him, I would say that he'd be very happy with having the same thing happen to Cuba that happened to Venezuela. Kind of take things over, but leave things intact. So with that being said, how do you feel about that? And I want you to go into the piece that came out on the website yesterday.
Okay, well, I mean, as a historian, I kind of look in a historical context. I understand that life always hasn't been great for Cuban, but, I mean, we have to look at the circumstance of the Cuban Revolution and the history of the U.S. In Latin America. And, I mean, I think the article pointed out that a lot of their economy, in the 50s, you had Batista, who was this brutal tyrant. I think he stole, $300 million from the Cuban treasury, and he invited the U.S. Mafia in, and Havana was this playground for the rich and, corrupt elements. And most of their economy was owned by the, U.S. corporate interests. Including their, sugar industry, a lot of the land were owned by, like, United Fruit Company, all the transportation, the banking. And that was, true in Latin America and a lot of countries in the early part of the 20th century. And that's why you had revolutions. And the Marines often sought to stamp them out brutally. I mean, in the Cuban case, you had the Platt Amendment. The U.S. directly colonized Cuba after the Spanish-American Cuban War, which the U.S. had intervened in a fraudulent pretext of claiming Spain had sunk the USS Maine, when in reality it was a fire or maybe even a false flag operation. And really, the U.S. wanted more control and to expand U.S. business interests, and they put in the Platt Amendment that basically allowed the U.S. the right to intervene militarily and gave various privileges to, American corporations and Americans in Cuba. So, does Cuba want to go back to that era? I mean, the Castro movement, overthrew the Batista. It was a very popular movement. It ousted the brutal dictatorship and it reestablished Cuba's sovereignty over its economy and instituted a socialist program that resulted in a very advanced healthcare system. Cuba sent many doctors abroad to Africa, and Cuba became a kind of symbol of the third world, standing up for itself. And yes, there have been uneven developments. There were some, I think, autocrat. The Castro did exhibit a heavy hand at times. but they've been under constant siege, you know, since the Cuban Revolution. The U.S. has tried to overthrow the Cuban government from the era of the Bay of Pigs on down and impose these crushing and brutal embargo and sanctions. So Cuba's economy can never really, you know, never able to develop to its full potential. So you have to all consider all that. So, I mean, yeah, there have been a lot of suffering in the Cuban people, but, you know, the United States is certainly a significant factor in that suffering, and they're the principle of which the revolution represents. And that's why a lot of the Cuban will defend the revolution. I mean, thousands came out in Havana. I don't know the precise number, but there are images of thousands of people came out to support Raul Castro after the indictment and, you know, made a statement that they'll defend the Cuban revolution as they have before when you had the Bay of Pigs. Castros were able to rally the people to defend Cuba and its sovereignty. So I think that the principle of sovereignty, national pride, and the potential of the Cuban revolution to create a more socially just society and economy, and many Cubans, whatever the hardship they're enduring, are willing to fight and stand up for that for good reason. And, you know, there's a lot of propaganda. People are easily propagandized. And there was an article in Common Dreams, I think it was Common Dreams or Mint Press, by McLeod, had a good article about the NED, National Endowment for Democracy, and how they're funding all these media outlets, and they plant stories, you know, to make it seem like Cuba, this black despotism, and if the regime is imminently going to collapse, and it's just propaganda. And in the U.S., we've been fed that propaganda for generations, so people have a skewed understanding of Cuba and what it represents, and they don't aren't necessarily aware of that history, which I think is very relevant and important.
Well, the piece that came out on the website yesterday, declassified government documents show Justice Department indictment of Raul Castro advances false claims. Can you talk about that?
Well, yeah, I mean, they're dredging up now. You know, it's obviously very politicized. The Trump administration, you know, is pushing this Monroe Doctrine and kind of imperialism on steroids around the world, you know, invading countries like Iran, kidnapping the Venezuelan president, and Cuba next on the radar. And, you know, Marco Rubio, as we know, the key driver of this, coming from the extreme right-wing elements in Miami who've had a vendetta against Castro all these years. And, you know, a lot of them come from the moneyed elite of Cuba that was forced to flee at the time of the revolution. So, you know, the agenda is clear. So now they're, you know, regime change, and now they're dredging up this incident from 30 years ago. But I looked into the incident, and the National Security Archive, I can direct listeners to look up the National Security Archive at George Washington University. Is a very good organization that lobbies for the declassification of government records, and then they employ historians once they and they file a lot of lawsuits, and once they're successful and get certain documents, then they their historians place those documents in context. So they write a kind of short essay, and then they present some of the key documents. So they have a good essay on this incident in 1996, because they, I guess, previously had pushed for some of the records in that incident, because that was a well-known incident in 1996. And what they found was that, well, I mean, the incident involved this exile group, right-wingers who had been linked with the Bay of Pigs and Mongoose, you know, terrorist attacks on Cuba, which the CIA had subsidized after the Cuban Revolution, that they were, you know, doing these flights into Cuba, and they were dropping leaflets supporting insurrection, and they were encouraging attacks on the Castros and even assassinations. And some U.S. officials started warning about these flights and said it was antagonizing the Cuban government. And
U.S. officials?
Yes.
That's interesting.
This is in the Clinton administration.
Right.
High-level officials or saying that these flights were antagonistic. And they actually said that the Cuban government had acted with great restraint. So they were praising the Cuban government's response, that they were very even-handed about the calm about this and restraint. But they said, you know, eventually, you know, they have a breaking point. And this is a violation of international law because they were violating the Cuban airspace and were viewed as terrorist threats on Cuba. And they said this could lead to an incident. They urged the measures to stop those flights. But inexplicably, some top-level officials disregarded their warning and recommendation. So that's where the suspicion lie, that this was some kind of setup, that they knew that it would cause some kind of incident that they could then use to sway public opinion, because you had the Helms-Burton law, curiously, or, you know, and FDR once said there's no coincidence in politics. Everything is planned. And, you know, Helms-Burton was this law that would allow, you know, Cuban businessmen who had lost property that was nationalized after the Cuban Revolution to sue the Cuban government and get compensation. And it had other hardline measures directed against Cuba. So it was a step up on the U.S., you know, regime change playbook and an economic war on Cuba. And the hard right had wanted that, but I guess Clinton was the president, and the mood wasn't right for him to support it yet, until this incident dramatically shifted public opinion, because, you know, it was all in the media, and Cuba was accused of terrorism, and there were a number of distortions. Christopher was the Secretary of State at the time, and he claimed that Cuba shot the plane down international waters. Actually, this recent indictment repeats that, but it was reported, I did a bit of research on this, and the Wall Street Journal reported that at least one of the plane that was shot down was directly in Cuban territory, so it was not in violation of international law, what Cuba did. But this, you know, the media was very sensationalistic. I mean, we have the pattern of yellow journalism that I think we've discussed on this show, and, you know, certainly with Russia nowadays, and, you know, any foreign enemy of the United States is often presented in the most lurid way, and, you know, yellow journalism, whether it's the New York Post or often the New York Times isn't that much better. It's supposed to be more sophisticated for liberals, whereas Post is more Trump conservatives, but the depiction may sometimes not be that different when it comes to foreign adversary like Russia or China or Cuba. So you had all these sensational stories, and Castro was, you know, Clinton said, you know, this shows the, you know, I have it in the article, the exact phrasing, but, you know, that these are, you know, barbarians or something to that effect. It shows how backward and repressive they are. And actually, the Wall Street Journal, which had some grounded reporting, but they had a big op-ed, and they said this, you know, it was because of Castro's, what's the word? It's kind of a stereotype that use of Latins, like, oh, he's overly emotional, and that's why he can't control his emotions, and temperamental, and that's why he did this. And that, I think, shifted public opinion, and Clinton then signed Helms-Burton, lo and behold, 2 or 3 weeks later. So this has all the appearance of a kind of staged incident. It could have easily been prevented if the U.S. Officials had followed through on the recommendations of some other pretty high-level officials to stop these flights. And the U.S. records show that U.S. government assessment was that the Castro had actually showed a lot of restraint throughout all this.
So what do you think is going to be the end result of this right now? Is it just another strategy in the Trump administration to eventually take over Cuba, or how do you view this?
Well, I can't predict how this will play out. You know, historians are notoriously bad at predicting the future. I think, yeah, it's clear they want to use this. You know, they're stepping up the game of regime change. I mean, they sent the USS Nimitz into Caribbean waters. This article by Alan McLeod showed that the NED and these other organizations, you know, Soft Power, are ramping up funding for propaganda initiatives and anti-Castro media. They're clearly targeting American public opinion as well. And I think they, are subpoenaing, Medea Benjamin, the Code Pink, were involved in the humanitarian mission and to raise awareness about the dire economic circumstance. And now she's been subpoenaed, and I guess they want to label her as, some kind of subversive or something, foreign raider or something. So this is, I think, fits together. They're clearly targeting Cuba. They've got a regime change operation. I mean, the CIA director was there. Rubio, made some calls. I think on the day of the indictment, Rubio called for regime change. There have been meetings with Raul Castro's grandson. I think, they're perhaps trying to coerce the Cuban government to make some major changes that could either pave the way for their downfall or restructure the economy in a way that probably Cubans do not want. But Cuba has faced attacks from the United States and the ongoing regime change operation dating to the early 60s. So whether the U.S. can achieve its goals is another matter. It's clear what the agenda is. Whether they'll go for an actual military assault or another Bay of Pigs-style operation, I'm not sure about that. And then there's a question of to what extent is the current Cuban government able to rally the Cuban people to defend their country and have enough military strength to withstand an attack. The huge crowds in support of Raul Castro would indicate a lot of the Cuban population is still supporting the Cuban Revolution based on the principles that I laid out a bit earlier. And the U.S. has been unable to achieve regime change since the 60s, even though they made conditions quite difficult on the island. So I can't say that the U.S. would be successful this time. And that's why I end the article that, Raul Castro had been one of the greatest nemesis of the CIA. And that's why they're continuing going after him. They'll go after his family or other remnants of the, other successors of the Cuban Revolution. But the odds of the Cuban Revolution surviving, I would say, are still pretty good. I mean, I can't be 100% certain in that. But again, my feeling is that the Cubans, a population as a whole, will defend their sovereignty. And they're aware of their history and the importance of the revolution, and know that even if the government had been imperfect, all revolutions in history, there's levels of imperfection and certain abuse of power that can develop. But the revolution itself is very important to sustain. I mean, look at China. Their 49 revolution. Look at China today. The country was a backward country that was completely divided and weakened and susceptible to foreign domination in the 19th century. And since the Chinese Revolution, 49, China's emerged as an economic powerhouse and rival to the U.S. today. So that's another example. The U.S. has tried for years to sabotage and destroy the Chinese Revolution and has failed. And it would likely fail with Cuba as well.
Well, Jeremy, we only have a minute left, and I want to direct the people to the website covertactionmagazine.com. And there's many articles in there recently from in the month of May, but there's articles all the time. But there's a few that you've written recently. The U.S. helps prop up 200-plus-year-old monarchy in Oman in exchange for access to military facilities. So that would be a good one to read to educate the listeners on what's going on there. And then there's another piece you just wrote the other day, last week. Let's see. Oh, that was on Ben and Jerry's. I don't have it in front of me, but Ben Cohen, who was looking to to do something about the budget. Here it is here. Ben and Jerry's co-founder spearheads campaigns to cut Pentagon spending and sustain companies' political activism. So that's another piece by you. So, Jeremy, hold on just a minute. I have to end this segment here, and I'll be back with you in a few seconds.
Sure. Thank you.